Passover, Easter, and Ramadan are just around the corner, and faith leaders are looking for ways to keep their congregations connected and hopeful.
Friendship can live, collegiality can live, interfaith solidarity can live.
And finding ways for rituals to remain central to our lives, I think, is going to be essential.
What's important for us is to look at the unique spiritual opportunity that people have now to develop that ritual in their own personal lives.
It's The Takeaway for Thursday, March 26th. I'm Duarte Geraldino. Also on the show today, how the VA is struggling to deal with the coronavirus threat for veterans and healthcare workers. Plus, we all need a little break when we're staying at home. So comedian Maria Bamford joins us to chat about how she's connecting with her fans online.
It's called Help Me, Help You, Help Me. I'm a white lady. I like to get in there and help out and then run away.
All right, busy show. Let's get going. In response to COVID-19, the Senate passed a $2 trillion stimulus plan. Senators say it's designed to help Americans and businesses struggling because of the coronavirus pandemic, but it's not a done deal just yet. The House will vote on the bill Friday. We'll keep you posted on how this massive economic plan moves forward. And as Washington decides in the bill, people are turning to faith leaders for answers. Churches, synagogues, mosques, and all sorts of places of worship are looking for creative ways to hold services while also protecting their congregations from COVID-19. Some of them are using drive-in services or experimenting with virtual reality, and at the very least, many are now streaming services online. Here's Reverend Jackie Lewis from Middle Collegiate Church in Manhattan addressing her congregation from her home last Sunday.
So what I'm saying to you, friend, wherever you are, is this virus is scary. This time is frightening. There is nothing great about this kind of fear, except maybe it unleashes us to live.
An Iman Omar Suleiman in Dallas, Texas, uses Facebook Live to offer nightly reflections to his congregation.
I'll give you guys a couple of seconds to log in. All right. Bismillah, alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salam, wa rasulullah, wa alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala. We begin with the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. We ask him to send his peace and blessings upon all of his messengers and prophets.
And here's Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum, senior rabbi at Congregation Bet Sima Torah, broadcasting to her New York City congregation via Zoom last Friday.
In the most profound sense, this crisis in which we find ourselves teaches us how little we are in control.
Leaders in the faith community are walking a tightrope right now. They're helping their congregations navigate all sorts of tech issues related to attending virtual services, while also trying to help members dealing with job losses, caring for sick family members, and struggling with the loneliness that may come with social distancing. Today, we're bringing three religious leaders together to talk about how they're walking that tightrope. Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum begins.
We have tried as a community to adjust to this situation by creating as many spaces online that it's possible for people to pray, study, and be together. We've created a congregational phone tree where we have divided up the entire congregation with volunteers calling every single household once a week and offering a prayer so that everybody is being reached out to by somebody in the congregation every week and connecting, hopefully, and having conversation. We now offer our Friday night and our Shabbat services via Zoom. We have counseling sessions, Shiva Minyanim, the services that we have after someone has died. We've even had a Zoom funeral.
Reverend Lewis, what about you?
Oh, my gosh. Good minds think alike. We have a congregation of about 1,300 people, Duarte. So we first started with worship online. And frankly, we've been streaming worship for 7 years. But now we're creating a fully virtual experience, meaning my sermon is being taped on Saturday. We're pulling archived beautiful music from our worship catalog. Our musicians are creating new pieces of music. We are crowdsourcing parts of our worship, like our passing of the peace, where we see lots of different kinds of faces sharing a greeting of peace. We've got lots of different folks reading scripture. Our Bible studies are in Zoom. We're having dance parties in Zoom. Our young adults are gathering in Zoom to talk about ethical leadership. So we're thanking God for technology and zeros ones that turn into beautiful connections so that we can stay together, praying together, learning together.
Iman Suleiman, Now, you've been streaming sermons online for years now. What kind of changes have you been making and have you seen in your audience given COVID-19?
Well, for one, there's been a quadruple increase in terms of online attendance with those sermons online. So I think we've recruited some new members from around the country to our congregation. But what I've also tried to do is try to do more lighthearted, you know, discussions, talks. So log on instead of giving a formal study. So I still do the Friday virtual sermon, but I also have just the nightly reflection. And I think that what we're seeing is that people have had all of their local mosque services moved online, whether that was just a weekly study or that was a weekly sermon. And so you're actually having members of various congregations now mix and match and sort of take the best of what they can find online with the current crisis.
But what about older members of the mosque in your community? How are they reacting to the closings and how are they transitioning online?
It's a largely elderly, retired population that were coming regularly, and this was their only social outlet. So it's not just that their worship space has been taken away from them, but their singular social space has been taken away as well. And I just actually spoken to, you know, the father of a friend of mine who's also a member of my congregation. He's 79 years old, and he joked, but he was, you know, only half joking. He said that, you know, I've been socially distanced for 13 years. So I've been practicing this for a very long time. And he laughed, but, you know, the reality is that unfortunately people do now have a compounded pandemic of loneliness. And that's especially true for our elderly population that also have to worry about being particularly vulnerable to the virus. And we're making it a point to do 5 calls a day, different people making 5 calls a day, preferably FaceTime, to just check in on people and then also make sure that all of their needs are taken care of. And spend some time at the door, you know, socially distanced. You can drop off a box at the door, but you could stand, you know, several feet away and just give someone the smile that they need to get themselves through the next few days.
You speak about the compounded epidemic of loneliness, and I'm sure so many people can empathize. Rabbi Kleinbaum, you mentioned earlier that your congregation held a virtual funeral. How did that actually work out for you?
Well, depending on what's happening in different cemeteries, we actually just did the service with another congregation. Everybody was in separate places, and the mourners offered eulogies, and there were 150 people on Zoom, but because they could be visible, they really were able to provide a lot of comfort. And then each night after that, it's Jewish tradition to have a gathering for Shiva, and we continued doing the same thing, and it was very moving. Zoom, you know, allows for the technology of people seeing faces, which is a very profound thing in this moment.
And what's the importance of actually continuing to hold these ceremonies?
Rituals are important. Rituals are vitally important. Finding ways for rituals to remain central to our lives, I think, is going to be essential to our moving through and surviving this particular plague. And we know that not all of us will individually survive, but how we survive as a community of values and full of God's presence and remaining true to who we are and what we care about in the world, I think rituals and community are going to be central to that.
Iman Suleiman, Ramadan is beginning in about a month. How are people preparing for that? And what does that preparation illustrate about the difference between observing spirituality in community versus on your own?
The entire year really centers around that month for the Muslim community. You know, the latest Pew statistics on religion showed that 80% of American Muslims fast, only 39% pray. And one of the reasons is that the daily prayers are very lonely, whereas Ramadan brings together the entire community. So people come to the mosque that don't attend throughout the year, and even those that do attend throughout the year attend on a daily basis. And so our mosques are bustling. We're breaking bread together, fasting together, praying together for hours into the night. And I think that the Friday prayer being taken away from us, which is unprecedented in our lifetimes, was sort of a mental preparation for what it would probably be like to not have our nightly prayer in the mosque. But with that being said, I do think that what's important for us is to look at the unique spiritual opportunity that people have now to develop that ritual in their own personal lives, to really cultivate Ramadan in their household. So instead of spending hours praying at the mosque, those who you know, are with their families, could pray for hours with their families, hopefully enjoy breaking bread with their families. And I think that it's going to be incumbent on the entire community then to really reach out once again to those that have already been very lonely. And we're looking to Ramadan as the one month of the year where they could have dinner with people every night, where they could bond with people throughout the night and make sure that we're including them as much as we can. And so I think the technology definitely helps in allowing us to connect to people. But at the same time, we're all deeply missing those things that cannot be replaced by technology. And as the rabbi beautifully said, you know, ritual is so important to survive these times. And it's important to show people that one of the ways that you express your sincerity to God is by doing the next best thing. And one of the ways that we demonstrate our true solidarity with one another is by doing the next best thing. And so we don't lose sight of the ideal, and we long for the ideal, and we hope that, you know, we're allowed those opportunities once again very soon. But at the same time, doing the next best thing is a sign of a pure intention and a sign of our genuine solidarity with one another.
Rabbi Kleinbaum, now there have been some calls right now from Jewish leaders to cancel travel during Passover. How will that impact the community, and what alternative plans are people making?
Well, we at CBST are going to be offering the Passover Seder via Zoom. I'll be leading it from my apartment, and we're asking people to sit in their own homes. We're sending out an email actually later this week giving instructions for those who have never done it themselves to put together the ritual objects necessary. So each person can be sitting in their homes having the Passover Seder, and I'll be leading all of these different Sedarim or Seders virtually.
Reverend Lewis, Easter is also coming up in just a few weeks. How is your congregation planning to celebrate that virtually?
We are not going to go to the sanctuary together, that is for sure. We will celebrate virtually. We know that it's not safe to go together. And just listening to the rabbi and imam lift up the kind of next best thing, I think in all of our Abrahamic faiths, there's this idea of choose life, the value of life. So we're going to love each other from afar. We're digging into ways to be creative. And we're remembering, Duarte, that the church, the religious church, started in homes. So to help people to think about their family, their neighbors, to be deeply local and think about the people in New York who live in their buildings, that Easter will be, yes, about worship and, yes, about beautiful music, but it's also about the heart touch. So go put a sign on your neighbor's door and say, I'm here. How can I help you? Make that a mikvah, to use a Jewish word. Make that a work that we do, an act of love. The resurrection in the Christian tradition is about new life. So even in the midst of all that is dying around us, we're asking ourselves, what can live? Friendship can live. Collegiality can live. Interfaith solidarity can live. Taking your neighbor some food can live. So how do we take those rituals that matter so much to us and make them deeply local right there in our neighborhoods and in our apartment buildings and in our homes?
It may be hard to believe, but as I talk with you right now, there are still some places of worship in the U.S. who are asking their members to continue meeting in person, in large groups, despite the risks of contagion posed by the coronavirus. Reverend Lewis is shaking her head.
I'm so startled by that. I'm praying for them and speaking against that as candidly as I can in the public square. You know, we would not put ourselves in a car and drive fast on an icy road because we know God loves us. We would not drink rubbing alcohol because we know God loves us. God's love is a given, but to put each other in an unsafe space to prove that, or as though God will protect us from a virus that is it's doing its thing to kill bodies, I just think it's foolish. And I hope anyone who's listening to us, who's hearing that from their clergy, will raise a sharp question about why they would encourage you to be in a space that is unsafe. The church is not the building. The church is the people.
Imam?
You know, I look back at the story of one of the great sages in Islam who was fleeing an oppressor, and he was told, you know, if you have such trust in God, why don't you go ahead and jump off of a cliff? And he said that God tests us, we don't test him. So let's not test God. That's not part of our faith in any way. God gives us the tools and the adjustments. And it's actually, I think, a flaw in creed to think that God needs us to gather. God does not need us to gather. We need to gather for God when that's possible. But in no way is God's glory taken from when we take the necessary precautions to worship in our homes for the sake of preserving his creation. If anything, that is a way of glorifying God.
Amen.
Rabbi?
In our tradition, it's very clear that pikuach nefesh, saving of a soul, can be more important than almost any obligation we have ritually. If somebody is sick on Shabbat, it is okay to violate every aspect of Shabbat to get them to have adequate medical care, to get them to a hospital, to take care of them. We even have the story of a famous rabbi during the cholera plague in 1860 who forced his congregation to eat on Yom Kippur, the holiest fast day of the year, because they needed to eat in order to be healthy and survive the plague itself. So we believe very strongly and that it is important to do all that it can to keep people healthy, physically healthy. And I feel like any of the religious leaders in my tradition who are gathering congregations of people together are irresponsible and violating, and I actually believe they are blaspheming God's name.
This is such a difficult moment for so many of us. We know that job losses are going up, and some of the unhealthy among us whose immune systems are compromised are thinking that they may not survive. How are you talking with members of your congregation who are facing these very tough decisions, preparing for end of life, and what it means to go through the next few months without stable income? Reverend Lewis?
We believe that Jesus is like love in the flesh. You know, Jesus is God come down. And what's in that for us as Christians is the way that God knows fully what it means to be human. And I would add that God wants us to know fully the parts of us that are divine. And in this way, death is a part of life. I mean, I've been saying to my folks, we are called into ministry by one who knew life and knew death, who knew fullness and hunger, who knew sorrow and joy. So it's a part of the human condition. Even in the valley of the shadow of death, the psalmist says, God is with us. So let us live every day fully and know that when death comes, we will have lived well and loved well and been kind and done justice and loved mercy. I'm really worried about the people who don't have enough food, who are losing jobs, and I'm thinking about how we as a human family can be making those lives more abundant, more full of joy, like to share what we have and make economic justice an imperative in these days.
Rabbi?
Unfortunately, we had our first death. The father of a beloved CBSD staff member passed away from this virus in a hospital on Long Island. And our community is mourning, and it is very difficult. His mother is also sick. He himself is sick. His two sisters are sick. So your question is a deep one. And we have to continually reach out to each other, continually use prayer to strengthen ourselves, continually remember that there are those who have been in terrible times in the past, and they've paved the way for the foundation on which we stand today. And likewise, we have to build a foundation for the future, even if some of us individually will not make it. And I keep speaking over and over again about the obligation not to despair, to be the reason people believe in the goodness of others, and to remember that joy is continually commanded of us, even when things are grim. And these are tough things, no question, and we have to keep building towards the future.
Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum is Senior Rabbi at the Congregation Beit Sima Torah. Iman Omar Suleiman is the founder and president of Yakin Institute for Islamic Research. Dr. Reverend Jackie Lewis is senior minister and at Middle College Church in Manhattan. Thank you all for joining us.
Blessings.
Thank you all.
Blessings. Bye-bye.
I'm Duarte Geraldino, and you're listening to The Takeaway. There's a lot of pressure on the Department of Veterans Affairs. In recent years, staffing and funding issues have plagued it. and it's still struggling to respond to high rates of suicide among veterans. Now, as COVID-19 spreads across the country, the VA is facing tough questions about how it's handling this crisis. As of this morning, the Veterans Health Administration confirms more than 360 of its patients tested positive for the virus. Many healthcare VA workers say they're not getting the protection they need to keep themselves or veterans safe.
It's supposed to be the backstop for the civilian healthcare system during a moment of crisis. And what I'm hearing is that the VA is barely able to take care of itself right now. And in many ways, it's way behind where it should be.
Aaron Glantz is a senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. He says the VA was already troubled before this pandemic, and that fact doesn't bode well for its healthcare workers and patients across the country.
The VA is entering this crisis short 44,000 frontline healthcare workers, thousands of doctors, over 10,000 nurse vacancies before this crisis started. So you're looking at the nation's largest integrated healthcare system that serves 9 million veterans annually. A majority of them are over the age of 65. Many of them have underlying health concerns related to war that make them especially vulnerable to the crisis. And the VA is dealing with this from the get-go, a little bit understaffed.
How have things changed since President Trump took office?
He has been emphasizing a move to private care at the VA and more quote-unquote choice for veterans. And many have said that this has led to neglect of the traditional integrated healthcare system. The VA is different from Medicare. Medicare is an insurance program. The VA is a hospital system. There are hospitals that are run by the government all around the country. And so one of the things that we're seeing across the country right now is that our system of private care is vulnerable to a pandemic because it is so diffuse and there's so many different parts of it to access and control. Well, the VA is a system that can be controlled, but it is entering this crisis understaffed in part because of neglect from the Trump administration.
Now, if you were to just base your view on the White House press briefings, you would think the system is doing incredibly well. But based on your reporting, what you have seen, how is it different?
The VA is saying that it has enough masks. There are adequate security protocols in place. They are saying that they have enough tests. And that is not at all what I'm hearing from frontline healthcare providers and veterans who are going in to use the VA. I talked to a frontline healthcare worker who had to drive 40 miles to get tested privately when she started to be sick with flu-like symptoms because there were not enough tests on hand at the VA. I talked to people that are frontline healthcare workers standing outside of the VA doing the screening, asking veterans who are showing up at their appointments questions to see if they have coronavirus, who were not equipped with masks until the union stepped in and provided them. I've talked to veterans who are walking into infusion drip wards to get regular IV treatments, surrounded by patients in chemotherapy, who said that none of the nurses were wearing masks. I've received emails directly, you know, obtained them from the VA, sent from supervisors to employees, telling people that even if they have been exposed to the coronavirus, that they should still come into work without being tested. And this is scaring the workers because they're worried that they could be spreading the disease amongst their elderly patients without even knowing that they had it.
We're talking about how COVID-19 is affecting the VA healthcare system. Aaron Glantz is with us. He's a senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. And as part of his reporting, he spoke with someone from a VA medical center in Wisconsin. A veteran tested positive there.
He presented at the clinic, and of course, at the moment he presented, they did not yet know that this patient was positive for COVID-19. Later, they learned that the patient was positive for COVID-19, and the supervisor informed the nursing staff there who treated this patient directly that they were to continue to come to work, even though two of those people actually were exhibiting flu-like symptoms themselves. And so those employees who interacted with this veteran, with the help of their union, they called the Department of Workers' Comp, they put in a workman's comp complaint. The county, the local county, put them under quarantine for their own safety and for the safety that they were interacting with. But if they had not taken these outside steps, they could have very easily been out there the very next morning treating vulnerable patients, potentially exposing them to this pandemic.
So what's the protocol for staff of the VA who are feeling ill or who could have been exposed to the virus? What are they supposed to do?
Well, the VA is saying that they are following the CDC guidelines. And the CDC guidelines say that if you have been exposed to a patient and you are not experiencing the symptoms of coronavirus, if you have a fever that is below 100.4, that you should continue to work. And this is really concerning staff because we know, you know, we keep getting this message out there in the public that if you've been exposed to the coronavirus in any way, that you should stay home. You know, Senator Rand Paul has been criticized because even after he got the test for COVID-19, after he got the test, but before he tested positive, he continued to go about his daily activities, potentially exposing other senators. Well, here we have our VA hospital staff dealing with people who are necessarily sick, many of whom are elderly, and the staff is saying that they're worried that they could be carriers of the virus. And in addition, they are reporting to me massive shortages of protective gear that makes them even more exposed to the patients who are presenting at their medical centers. So I'd say that the two biggest concerns are, one, that the staff at these hospitals, nurses, doctors, and others are literally putting their lives on the line each and every day, and they are terrified because they do not have adequate protective gear. And then second of all, they are worried that because they don't have protective gear and they are interacting with vulnerable patients, that they may indeed be spreading it amongst their patients. And so they are asking for, you know, more conservative protocols and more availability of testing. There seems to be very little, if any, testing available to VA staff that I can see, although the VA is telling me that they have adequate tests in place.
Aaron Glantz is a senior reporter at Reveal, where he's been reporting on the VA's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Aaron, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Daniel Muller. I'm calling from Salem, Oregon. As a veteran, I can make a long laundry list of faults of the VA healthcare system, but it's my personal experience. It has not been good. I feel they are underpaid and undermotivated to do their work.
I always find the VA facilities to be dirty and understaffed. People, for the most part, that work there are uncaring and hurried. What I think we should do is all the representatives in the House and all the senators in the Senate should be taken out of their elitist health care plans that we pay for and be placed in the regular VA system. Maybe by then the veterans will start getting the care we deserve.
This is Vicki from Cloquet, Minnesota. I get all of my care through the VA in Twin Ports. I get excellent care there, and I am very, very grateful that I have them, particularly when the situation is like it is today.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
About 600,000 people go missing every year in the U.S., prompting family members to become amateur detectives. On the trail of one missing person is journalist Tanya Mosley.
Why do you think you hesitated when we first met in telling me the full details about your mother's disappearance?
It's heartbreaking. I didn't want to break your heart.
I'm Kai Wright. Tanya Mosley joins me next time on Notes from America. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Duarte Giraldino, broadcasting from my home with my newborns in the next room. So you're probably going to hear my twins in the next segment. Welcome to my house. Now, I could use a laugh right now. How about you? Most comedy venues across the country are closed right now, but many comedians are finding ways to tell jokes and connect with you online. This month, comics Mike Barbiglia and Roy Wood Jr. started an Instagram live show to raise money for comedy club employees. Since then, Barbiglia has invited a number of different comedians to workshop material that they were planning to test out in front of in-person crowds. Here's stand-up comedian Maria Bamford on the online show earlier this week.
Quick question for you, Mike. If I stopped eating sugar and white flour, would I ever be able to stop talking about it?
Maria, for me, it's like I have so much more energy. And it's like I've been clean, 23 days. And I'm present for my relationships.
I know you are. I know everything's changed. The world is topsy-turvy.
You might know Maria from Arrested Development or her Netflix show, Lady Dynamite. Well, she's also been performing stand-up for her fans over Zoom. She's using those Zoom sessions to raise money for food pantries and her own part-time employees. And as part of a series of check-ins that we'll be doing with different comedians in the coming weeks, I got her online to chat. She had mixed experiences so far with social distancing.
First, it was an introvert's paradise. I was enjoying the first few days of it, and now I do miss the hugs from strangers. I didn't realize how many hugs that I get from strangers on the regs. I hadn't accounted for that loss.
Maria also says while the stress of the virus hasn't stopped her from working on new jokes, she's getting used to live streaming, and it's changing how she connects with her audience.
I don't know if it's good or it's bad, but I don't have that sense of social editing of like the room tightening up or when you bring up a certain topic. So like one topic that I've been kind of worried about talking about, I'm in a billion 12-step groups, and I haven't been wanting to talk about that just because I get anxious about it. But now because I don't get any response, I'm talking about it. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, if just my newfound confidence in talking about subjects because I don't see the look on people's face and I don't sense any sort of social anxiety about it. So that's interesting. But for sure, I definitely miss the laughter and connection that you have with people in real time and having, you know, with warm bodies and beautiful faces in front of you. I'm missing that for sure.
You speak about having been members of these 12-step groups, and I understand you speak openly about your own history with depression and OCD. Do you have any advice for people who may be struggling with mental illness trying to get through this moment?
Well, and this is just from my own experience, oh my God, stay on your meds. This is no time to feel super unstable when there isn't a lot of access or resources. So, yeah, just take care of yourself the best as you can, which I think is a general thing to do with mental health and for everybody. But I think it is really interesting just because it's a time where you talk to your therapist and they go, oh, yeah, you know what, all those paranoid and anxious thoughts you had, they're actually kind of right on. you actually kind of had a pretty good picture of what the world was like. So let that be a joy that, you know, whatever fears you had, but actually you were accurate. And, yeah, to connect as much as you can and take care of yourself, but it's a hard time, and if you are feeling really bad, suicidal, do the same things. The suicide hotlines, I know there's wait time on them, and that's depressing. No, you're not alone.
Are you social distancing alone, or are you with people?
No, I have my hub, my hubby, and our two dogs, and so I'm very lucky in that sense, and I'm also on all my meds, and I had my meds upped a little bit because I was starting to have trouble sleeping at night. I think it's a good time to be in touch with whatever professional you talk to, if you have a therapist or online therapy. If you've never tried online therapy, anything will do in a pinch. I had one of my jokes is that I did have an online therapist from BetterHelp.com, and she she texted me, Christine, of course you're stressed. You just had a baby. And you know what? That was helpful. but it made me think of Christine and her baby, and maybe I shouldn't be so whipped up.
Are there any new ways of doing comedy and reaching out to community online that you're hoping to experiment with as we continue to socially distance ourselves?
Yes. Oh, I've also had, I think, 8 sessions with different fans. It's called Help Me, Help You, Help Me, where I try to, quote unquote, help you. I may harm you. I'm a white lady. I like to get in there and help out, and run away. And yeah, so I've been doing that, and that's been hilarious. Just to, you know, it's, most people seem to want to have comedy writing feedback, but I've also helped somebody with advice of a new car. I love to spout off about stuff. I'm 50. I have an opinion about almost anything. And so that's, I think it's a real, I don't want to be creepy and say it's an opportunity, but, you know, human beings, that is one of the beautiful things about nature, is that it finds a way. And so I think a lot of, I went to an open mic online. It's super fun and just as awkward. And I think there are, just like every awful thing, there's always positive things, and just like every positive things, there's always something super awful about it. I believe that's a Patton Oswalt premise, where he talks about, like, as soon as we get a gay female president, we're all going to start eating each other. There's going to be just, which is so beautiful. But I think a lot of people are being very creative, and that's wonderful.
Thank you so much. Maria Bamford is a comedian. Her most recent stand-up special is called Weakness is the Brand. Thanks so much, Maria.
Thank you so much for having me. Best of health to you and your family and friends.
That's it for us today. What a week it's been. Thank you for listening and trusting us with your time. This virus is making it tough on all of us. You are not alone. We hear you. Your thoughts, your ideas help shape our coverage. We always love to hear from you, so please share your thoughts with us. Thousands of people in the Takeaway community continue to reach out, and if you want to weigh in, just call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can always send us a tweet at The Takeaway, or to me at Duarte Geraldino. Quick shout out to the team making this show happen from all parts of the East Coast this week. Our senior producer is Alexander Boti, and our producer team is Ethan Oberman, Amber Hall, Patricia Jacob, Jackie Martin, Andres O'Hara, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen-Laird. Polly Arungo is our digital editor. Katerita Barton is our intern. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. David Gable is our executive assistant. And Lee Hill is our executive producer. At the station, our board operator and sound engineer, Debbie Daughtry, and our director, Jay Cowett, and producer, Jose Olivares. We appreciate you. Amy Walter is on tomorrow. Until next week, I'm Duarte Geraldino, and you've been listening to The Takeaway.